Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, we talked with Catherine Arnold about her recent book, Pandemic 1918. Today, AWM President Kerry Cranston chats with Pulitzer Prize winner and global energy expert Daniel Yergin about his timely new book, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. This conversation took place October 8th, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. Quick programming note, near the 20-minute mark, Kerry and Daniel start discussing some of the pictures included in the book. If you would like to follow along with them, you can find this full discussion, including the photo slideshow, on the American Writers Museum's YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
My name is Kerry Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. Our guest tonight is a respected authority on energy, world politics. Did I say tonight? I meant today. Our guest today is a respected authority on energy, world politics, and economics, as well as a friend of the museum, Daniel Yergin. He's the Pulitzer Prize winning author of The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, as well as numerous other books on energy and international relations. He is vice president of IHS Market, one of the leading information and research firms in the world, a member of the board of the Council on Foreign Relations, a senior trustee of the Brookings Institution, and has served on the Secretary of Energy Advisory Board under the last four presidential administrations. His latest book is The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. So welcome, Dan Yergin. Dan, nice to have
you. Thank you very much, Kerry. I'm really glad to be on this broadcast of the American Writers Museum. I wish I was there in person. I have to say that the American Writers Museum is a great institution and a great contribution to our national life. And really, congratulations to you and all of your colleagues and supporters who've really filled what was a big void in our national life. And so I'm glad to be part of it today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And we're thrilled at your support, and we're thrilled that we got to have you here today, at least virtually, for a talk about your new book. But before we get into the details of your first book, you know, I wanted to talk to you about, your work as a writer. I really enjoyed the new book. I can now say I'm extremely more knowledgeable about the global energy market and how it intersects with issues of climate change and the function of technology. All of those things, but the content of the book is really amazing. You really aren't someone who was an expert who became a writer about your field of expertise. You're really a writer who became an expert.
I think
what I've seen.
That's right. I mean, ever since I was a child, I was writing. My father had been a reporter at the Chicago Tribune, so I was raised on stories about stories. And, you know, I just started doing it. And so whether I was in grade school, in high school, in college, I was always starting publications and always writing, and just kind of part of my identity that I just assumed I would do that. And what happened really is that my kind of intellectual interests in energy, geopolitics, the clash of nations, all that came together with my writing. You know, when I was a postgraduate at Harvard, I had 2 years, nobody was supervising me. So I got to do what I'd done, because I'd done my PhD in another subject, and I just became obsessed with it. But at the same time, you know, for me, it's writing, narrative, telling stories, engaging people is very much part of what I like to do. And, you know, one of the things I love, you know, I write, and then I really love to sort of edit and polish the work and the words and, you know, get the transitions just to work right. So I care a lot about the writing, and it's, you know, it's something that it's just been part of my identity since pretty much as far back as I can remember.
Well, it reminds me of that notion of David McCullough was here when we were opening the museum, and you know, I think someone even said to him, you know, or may have referred to him as a historian, and he doesn't like to be called a historian. He likes to be called a writer. Because writing is what he does, his subject is that. But I think, you know, you're someone who is very illustrative of the fact that writing gives you authority. If you're an author, you have authority. You take control of the narrative, you tell the story, you shape it. So it's really powerful. That's why we exist, is really to inspire people on that mission.
Yeah, it is interesting, because the difference between, obviously, between fiction and nonfiction, I mean, it's you know, nonfiction, you have to stay located in whatever kind of facts that you're using. But I think that even writing is a history, and part of this book is history, part of the book is the present, and part of the book is about the future. But for me, even I actually think history is an imaginative act. I mean, when I'm writing, it's kind of like a movie. I see it, and I'm sort of writing what I'm seeing as near as I can tell as to what I'm doing. So, yeah. There's a very clever transition, which I'm very proud of, from the introduction to the first sentence of the first chapter. And so it says we have to go where our story begins. And then I say, if you want to get to the beginning of the shale revolution, you got to get on Highway E35 going out of Dallas. And very visual images of what you see as you do that. So it's to convey the vividness, and at the same time, make your argument and your analysis kind of to integrate them.
Yeah, and you really do spend a lot of time shaping these different stories together and interweaving them. You know, you've got a lot of characters, and you really do take real people and make characters of them. And so can you tell me a little bit about how you, as you're doing your research and you're working on this, how you're also looking at those stories and how they fit together?
Well, I'm always very interested in stories. I mean, when I was younger, kind of, my wife would tell me when we'd be with people, I would interview them. It was just something, you know, I'm really interested in people's stories, how they got from here to there, what was planned, what was accidents of life, the contingencies that got you there. And so I've always been interested in the stories. So I'm always listening and I'm looking for the voices. And then I guess thinking, you know, I sort of think, who are the emblematic characters? Who carries the story in some fashion, some important thing? And so, for instance, for the story of the Tesla and the rise of the electric car, it's not Elon Musk, but it's a fellow named J.B. Straubel, who's a technical director, who's the one who first tried to convince Elon Musk to do an electric airplane. He said, I'm not interested, but I might be interested in an electric car and, you know, look at the impact of that. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm also, you know, stories are about surprises and contingencies. You know, something happens. The shale revolution, which is so important to the U.S. economy, what's called fracking. We heard some of it, you know, in the debates. Yeah. It might not have happened if some guy hadn't gone to a baseball game and met somebody else who told him about this other technology. And, well, there's one last try. Let's try this other technology. So I love those sort of almost real life cliffhangers.
Yeah. And the book is full of them, which I found so enjoyable for someone who knew literally nothing about this topic, to get so enthralled in it. And it was those stories, you know, you talk about cliffhangers, you know, there's the gentleman whose name I don't remember who, you know, put all of his money and all of his hard work into setting up a distribution center to receive liquid natural gas in Louisiana.
And yeah, right.
Was then finding out that the U.S. was not going to be importing and had to suddenly change everything he was doing. You know, yeah. Great story.
Yeah, a fellow named, that's right, Sharif Suki. I mean, an amazing story. He's invested billions of dollars and then finds out it's all wrong. It's not going to work. The U.S. is awash in national gas, and can you turn it around? And, you know, this is, he's not a big company. He's a guy.
Yeah.
Yet, you know, it makes it happen.
A little bit, if you don't mind, about this process a little bit more too for you, which I've read about you, and I just want to explore a little more, is this notion of how you write, which is very much like Maya Angelou, and I don't know if you know that. But can you talk a little bit about your physical process of writing?
People think it's funny these days to know that I write longhand, but you know, we are influenced by our parents. My mother was an artist, and when I was a child, I would watch her sketching, and she'd build up a sketch. And I feel that when I'm writing, what I'm doing is I'm building up a sketch of, you know, it almost looks like a sketch on a page, and I put this piece there and that piece there and start to connect them and trying to get the flow. And the reason I do longhand is because, you know, if we're sitting at a computer, we're like this. And if, you know, if you're longhand, you can stretch out on a couch and be a bit more in a dreamlike state. And I, you know, I once remember reading that Dickens would describe as sort of in a half dreamlike state writing. Now, not Dickens, but he did write longhand, clearly. and he didn't have a computer, even a word processor, a typewriter. And I just find that process is very helpful for creating that sort of integrated flow of of stories and so forth. So I do that. Then the physical, well, first, of course, the first thing you do is you jump in, you swim into it. I mean, I did not map out the new map. What I did is I, take one part, get into it, and let the material kind of lead me to where I'm going. Where is this story going? So I'm following the story too. What's the outcome? And then I get there, and I've forgotten everything over there. I'm not thinking about there. I'm just focused on that, shape that in the way I described. Then the physical process, then I have to admit my handwriting is getting worse. So I have to, then I have to pretty quickly put it into the, into computer, start typing, shaping it that way. And then of course, what you have with the, computer is you have that flexibility to move things around. Is this in the right place? Where does the verb belong in the sentence? And all those kind of questions. What I learned from my 10th grade writing teacher is transitions. How do you move from one point to another? So kind of can do that. So I build it up. And then at some point I said, you start off saying, I'm not sitting down to write a book. I'm not sitting down to write a chapter. I'm just writing some paragraphs. But at some point you look and say, this is beginning to look like a chapter. I think I'm getting there. And, you build it up. Then the other thing somebody once said to me, an editor, you need to know everything, but your readers don't. Then you have to, you have to get it down. So the prize, the book you mentioned, is like 900 pages. The quest was 700 pages. This is, if you don't include Roman numerals, is 491 pages for age, and you don't have to, So the process of cutting. Then the other thing I do, which is a little odd maybe, is I read it aloud to myself. And does that flow? And when you do that, because you're so involved and invested in the words that if you don't do that something that slow, you don't see things. And that sort of gives you more of that flow that you want. So that for me is kind of the process. There's always what the psychologists call approach avoidance. I'm not somebody who writes, 4 hours a day every day. I mean, because I do other things and it's, so big blocks of time. But, just to say, okay, I think I'm here now. I think I can do this and just start sketching and see where it goes. So that for me is the process.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And like I said, both your notion of writing longhand and that kind of lying back or lying down, I don't know if you knew that it's here in the museum. We talk about Maya Angelou's process at one point, and she wrote longhand on yellow legal pads in a hotel room normally, lying down.
Who did?
Maya Angelou.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Good. That, her process. She had a typewriter and she had other machines, but that was how she started all drafts, was in that same process.
Well, it's just, you're just connected in a different way. I think. And as you say, you're more in that, I'm sure for her, it was the same thing, more in that sort of, not dreamlike, but sort of semi-dreamlike state.
Yeah. And now, you and I talked about this briefly, but I'm kind of curious on, you've got a book that is, you've talked about how you shaped it and how you kind of worked through the process of it. But as you mentioned, it's 492 pages. A number of those pages are footnotes.
So actually the real book is shorter than 491 pages. I want to make that clear.
but there's a lot of research that goes into a book like this and just a huge amount of work. But this book is also incredibly timely. You're literally talking about COVID. Can you talk a little bit about how long you were working on this book and how long you went until it went to the printer?
Sure. So I think I worked on it about 4 years, piece by piece. And pretty much by last winter, it was pretty much shaped where it was going. I still hadn't done the two most difficult things I find, which is to write the conclusion and the introduction, which is what you want the reader to take away and why you wrote the book. And I always feel that the introduction really needs to be a roadmap telling, where this book is going to go. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we, in our company, we put on this conference with 6,000 people every year. It was going to be 85 countries in Houston, second week of March. And I think, you know, when COVID first appeared, we now know more about what was going on behind the scenes. But I think people tended to think about it as, if you remember the SARS epidemic in China at the beginning of the century. But you look at SARS, 8,000 people became sick and less than 800 passed away. And I think that was a mindset, oh, this is like that. But we were going to do this conference, and some doctors said, if you do that, people are going to get really sick. You're going to have 6,000 people in a hotel. So the beginning of March, we canceled it, you know, like a week and a half in advance. And people were shocked that we did it, because it was not, you know, it was not till the middle of March that began to understand. And that also said to me, look, this book is going to be different, you know. And since I wasn't traveling, you know, I could just sort of full-time focus on this. So between March and July, I really looked at every part of the book about, like, let's say, ride-hailing, Uber. You would have said one thing about it in February of 2020, another thing now, because it just how it affected everything. And then determined that obviously I was going to write a new chapter, because it was not only about the virus, but it was to the energy world. I mean, we had what I call in the new map an economic dark age. Now I'd call it an economic twilight zone. Still a very serious, threatening economic situation on top of the health situation. But you had this collapse in oil prices, and suddenly Russia and Saudi Arabia declaring an oil war against each other. And these very dramatic events in which the United States had become the world's number one oil producer. And Donald Trump had said, I hate OPEC. But then he realized that he had this big domestic industry with about, which had before COVID, 12.5 million people might collapse. You had something called negative prices. People producing oil were paying people to take their oil away because there was so much oil in storage. And so you had this very dramatic series of events. You know, great geopolitical drama between the U.S. China, between U.S. Russia and Saudi Arabia, and then I was able to continue to sort of pursue it. And so, finally, in mid-July, you know, you get sort of, they send you one pass, they call it, like your galleys. I was now on the third pass. And they said, if you keep doing that, you're not going to have an index. So I thought, well, a book like this needs an index. So it was about that point in mid-July that they finally, that famous phrase, you don't finish a book, your publisher takes it away. They, Penguin, took it away. They were quite right. And within 2 months, amazingly, the book was published. So I was, you know, so I think if anybody reads it, they'll feel this book caught the curve. It's about, this book is about where we are now, not where we were several months ago.
Yeah. It's amazing that you, a writer's process, you know, the idea that they took it from you in July and that it's out already and that people are reading it is really just
Penguin was great. They were very, you know, they were a little bit exasperated with me and worried. And of course at Penguin, like everywhere else, everybody's working at home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, their whole process is the copy editor's there, the proofreader's there, the editor's there, but they brought it all together and, you know, did a great job. And, you know, and I have to say, I think the book is beautiful. I love the typeface of the book. It's very physically, I know you're reading on a Kindle, but if you look at the hardcover, it's very elegant and readable, just physically. Well, and then, by the way, I say one other thing. I don't know what they did. It's very lightweight.
Well, sometimes it's the paper that they choose.
Yeah. So it's, you know, if you read it in bed, it's not going to asphyxiate you. I mean, it's very lightweight.
They, you know, you bring up, you know, the notion of, on top of all of that, the one of the things that's in the book, and again, to make people not afraid of the 492 pages, is that you have a lot of pictures. You choose your pictures, you choose your captions. Tell me a little bit about that process and why it was important or something.
Well, I'd done it, you know, when I did my original, you know, my first big oil book was the second, really, The Prize. We had a photo gallery, and it was because of the photo gallery that it became a PBS, BBC series that like 20 million people saw. Mm-hmm. And so I've just learned it was really important to use the photos as another way to tell the story, and not just boring photos of people standing there like that, but, you know, really interesting photos with things going on. And then those need to be integrated so that the captions, everyone has a punch to it that connects back to the book. And so you can almost follow the story by looking at the pictures and, you know, and get drawn into it and say, wow, you know, this is really interesting. So I see the pictures and the captions as a very integral part of the book, not just a sort of addendum there to illustrate something, but they're part of the story.
And so on that, what I'd like to do, and I'm going to remind the audience that we're going to get to a Q&A section in a little bit. And what I'd love is if folks would use the Q&A button at the bottom of the screen, type in a question that you might have. And Dan, I'm going to bring up, hopefully I can do this right, some of those pictures from the book. So rather than just asking you to summarize the book and all of its different sections and stuff, I thought we could walk through a few of the pictures and you can kind of say what the picture is and how it relates to the book. And I've put these pretty much in the order of the book, I think. The first one, these two pictures, the gentleman on the left and the diagram, can you kind of explain shale and what this all is?
So the one on the right, just to explain it, is what a shale well is. It drills down 2,000 feet and then might go 2 miles horizontally. And that was the breakthrough to be able to take this very dense rock that all the textbooks said you can't produce oil and gas from it, figure out how to do it with what we heard, you know, that term fracking, hydraulic fracturing, and then that horizontal wells. So these are very high tech and you need really advanced computer digital capabilities to do it. So the guy on the left who's pointing there is a guy named George P. Mitchell. That is one stubborn guy. He was the one who had this idea that you could get shale gas and then turned out oil out of the rocks. And he was, people said, you're crazy, you're wasting your money. He said, well, it's my money. He owned the dominant position in his company. It took 18 years before they finally had 16 years till the breakthrough and then another few years. And I remember talking to his granddaughter and she said, you know, one quality he has, he was really stubborn. And if he hadn't been stubborn, you know, most companies would have said, this isn't going anywhere, let's close it down, waste of money. He got a lot of criticism even internally, but he said, you know, I know this has to work somehow. And it worked to the degree that the U.S. has gone from importing 60% of its oil, and you see the impact of that, you know, when you went to buy gasoline, to where we're now the world's largest oil producer. Pretty amazing. And his determination.
He also, as you pointed out in the book, was very much an environmentalist, that he went into this wanting to, you know, stop coal and other things.
Yeah, he created this garden community called the Woodlands outside Houston. And so he was very much, you know, he saw natural gas as preferable to coal. Once out of the blue, I got a phone call from him, you know, I hadn't said anything, but somehow he thought I'd said something about coal, and he was, you know, natural gas is a cleaner fuel. And what we've had in our, you know, the U.S. today, our CO2 emissions are down to the levels of the 1990, although our economy's doubled. And it's largely because natural gas has replaced coal and electric generation. So that's kind of where it all started.
And then you move through a lot of information about the U.S. and where we're at. And then you kind of jump into Russia. And I just threw this picture in because I thought it was kind of funny.
This guy is a guy who won a judo championship when he was about 25. And in the Leningrad Evening News, they said, you're going to hear more from him. Well, we have heard more from him. It's Vladimir Putin. And I think of him in international affairs as a judoist. He has a weak hand. Russia's economy is only somewhat bigger than Spain's, but he takes advantage of other people's weaknesses to advance. And so I think what he does in, you know, people think of Russia as chess player. I think he's as the Russians called him, a judoist. And I think he applies judo in international affairs. He's punching or throwing, I guess, in this case, above his weight.
And this shot here with pipeline.
Oh, those are the good old days when it was okay to build a pipeline from Russia under the Baltic Sea to Germany. It was called Nord Stream 1, and there's Chancellor Merkel and then Russian President Medvedev, and they're turning the pipe to open it up. And this was considered a contribution to energy security to bring more clean natural gas. Today, it's a point of this Nord Stream 2, which is the current pipeline, $11 billion, 3 weeks from being finished. The U.S. put sanctions on it last December, and it's become a huge contention between Russia and the United States, and very divisive in our relationship with Germany right now. And it's front and center in this whole issue of sanctions and Russian interference in the U.S. presidential elections and all those other factors. So those were happy days. You wouldn't see a photo like that today.
Nope. And this, about China and Putin.
Yeah, so there's Putin with Xi Jinping, who's the president of China, and showing them, Putin is showing them how to make Russian pancakes, which are called blinis. And these guys have developed a really close relationship. So much so that on Xi's birthday, Putin brought him his favorite flavor of Russian ice cream. But at the same time that they were cooking up their pancakes, they were cooking up something much bigger, which Chinese troops for the first time were participating in a massive Russian military war games. And the relationship between Russia and China has gotten much closer, based partly on energy, partly on tensions with the United States, partly on the nature of their regimes. And the two they describe each other as each other's best friends. And a real geopolitical reality is this new relationship between Russia and China, which is something that, you know, matters a lot, will matter a lot in the future to the United States. But they're going to continue to cook together.
Yeah. And I find it funny that Jackie Chan makes it into the book. So if you want to.
I want to make a prediction here, Carrie, that this will be the only book on energy and geopolitics and climate that has Jackie Chan. Why is Jackie Chan in this book? Is because China has this great $1.4 trillion project they call the Belt and Road to make the Middle Kingdom, the middle of the world economy, to make China central through Central Asia, South Asia, into Europe, into Africa. Even in a discussion that President Xi had with the President of Panama, even the Panama Canal. But it's not only a geopolitical, an energy, a strategic route thing. It also has an aesthetic side to it. So there's a Belt and Road Film Festival. And in that film festival, this movie was one of the starring attractions, which is a movie called Kung Fu Yoga. And it's about a Chinese and Indian archaeologists who together discover in their cooperation a great new a great treasure, and Jackie Chan is the professor in it. And the line it says there, they said, it's so great our cooperation, and the lady archaeologist from India says it would also be in line with the One Belt One Road policy. And I think it's Jackie Chan says, so well said. So it's a way to demonstrate that the Belt and Road has many dimensions, and it's something that's a very important feature of what's happening in global politics.
Yeah, and then this is an interesting thing about China, and do you want to kind of explain this story?
Again, it strikes me so often that big breakthroughs sometimes come out of big organizations, sometimes come out of one guy. This guy's called Malcolm McLean. And he grew up in a town in North Carolina called Shoeheel, North Carolina. And he ran a trucking business, and he was moving goods from the East Coast, driving down to Texas. He said, there has to be a cheaper way to do it. What about driving the truck body right onto a ship and having a ship do it? And that became what is known as container shipping. So what you're seeing in the other picture is a container ship. And these are a huge, massive ship going into Shanghai's harbor. And this is what made China so central in the world economy, made China the workshop of the world, because all these containers come to Long Beach, California, or Los Angeles, or New York, or Savannah, and so forth, and connect China to the world. This is kind of what really made kind of modern globalization as we have now have it, when you, you know, have so much from China when you shop either online or in a store. And it's because of container shipping, because it made it economic to move cargoes. Because normally you used to have a lot of guys, longshoremen who would, you know, lift and pull and do things. Now, you know, just those containers get hoisted from the back of a truck or a train, put on the ship, move 5,000 miles across the ocean. Another hoist takes them off and they end up in at Walmart.
Wow. And China is literally building islands.
Yes. So there's a body of water called the South China Sea, which is south of China, off Southeast Asia. And it is the most important highway for world commerce. One third of world commerce flows through it. China claims the South China Sea basically as its own. And it has a map that it calls a 9-line map, saying for historic reasons, this has always been China. The US doesn't accept that. All the countries, Vietnam, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines around it don't accept it, but China has moved in and on a group of islands has built up 3,200 acres, reclaimed 3,200 acres, and turned them into basically floating aircraft carriers. Those are runways that can take bombers on them. And the US is challenging this. China is worried, particularly one thing China really doesn't like is the US Navy and the US Navy's freedom of seas, because it says if there's a controversy over Taiwan or something else happens, the US could interrupt their flow of oil, among other things. And so they've built this up, and the US doesn't accept it. And although people don't realize it, there have been several near collisions of US and Chinese warships exactly because of the different views of the South China Sea. So to me, one of the things I wanted readers to know is if you say, where might more serious problems come in world affairs, it could come in the South China Sea, which is not on most people's mindset right now. But keeping it, you know, looking at what's happening there tells you that there's basically a military buildup in that region.
Yeah. And obviously we tend to think of Saudi Arabia as this and the Arab world as the center point of oil, but it's not so much anymore.
Now Saudi Arabia shares the dais with the United States and with Russia. So on the left is Mohammed bin Salman, who's the crown prince who really runs the country, sitting under his picture of his grandfather, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, who created modern Saudi Arabia. It only became a real country in 1932. And Mohammed bin Salman will be the next king when his father in that picture there passes away. And one of the things that's happened is that Russia has developed a kind of strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia. So this is when Putin was visiting in October, just a year ago, actually, a state visit. And as a gift, they love falconry in the Arab world, brought him, of course, the world's largest falcon, which is an Arctic falcon. Mm. And you can see King Salman was very happy to receive this as his present. I forgot the name of the falcon, but it kind of signifies their relationship. So it was a Siberian falcon in Saudi Arabia.
And in the book, you kind of move out of this geopolitical conversation and start talking about technology. This picture kind of illustrates that notion of how technology also drives these issues. Kind of want to explain.
So Carrie, we are in an energy transition. The energy mix is changing. A lot of debate about the change of it. And I try and have a framework for thinking about energy transition. You know, the term is clean energy, wind and solar. And I wanted to convey that energy transitions have been going on for a long time. And it was in the 14th, it sort of began in the 13th and 14th century when the price of wood went through the roof in England and people started using coal for heating. But I date the beginning of the energy transition that we're still living through to January of 1709. This is a village called Colebrookdale in Shropshire in England. And there was an iron worker there named Abraham Darby, and he figured out how to use coal to make iron in an improved process over burning wood. And so I say, you know, Colebrook Dale is really when the energy transition began. And here we are in the year 2020, and we're still in energy transition. We went from coal to oil, natural gas, nuclear. And the interesting thing is how long it was that, you know, 19th century Britain ruled the waves, their ship, coal, steam, and everything. It wasn't until the beginning of the 20th century that coal actually became half of world energy supply. Oil was discovered in the U.S. in 1859. It wasn't until the 1960s that coal took over from coal. So, you know, so that's part of the discussion today about how fast energy transitions can happen, and, you know, and say in a sense being realistic about it.
And some of the technologies, these are four different people on the same topic.
Right. Well, the two people on the left, the two people with the top one is Thomas Edison with his electric car. And he put a lot of money and effort into getting an electric car, never gained traction. And then down below is a reincarnation of Thomas Edison, Elon Musk, who, you know, that's one of those stories. You know, if he hadn't gone to a fish restaurant in the early 2000s and met some guys who wanted to talk about an electric airplane and then electric car, maybe we'd never have the Tesla, and electric car would still be back with Thomas Edison. But so that, you know, I just like the photograph because you saw it was like a century apart, but you saw one great innovator and then another. On the other side is Mary Barra, who is the CEO and chairman of General Motors. And I had a conversation and I interviewed Mary for the book. And she says that her goal for General Motors is zero collisions, zero congestion, and zero emissions. So GM, like others, is moving towards an electric car. Combine it, well, we'll get to ride hailing. And the guy below him is Mr. Wang, who was the father of the electric car in China. He was Minister of Technology. And he's really pushed it. And China is where you have half the world's electric cars now. So I think he and Elon Musk are really the two, if we said the fathers of the modern electric vehicle, it's those two guys.
Okay. And obviously that's going to have a huge impact on the energy industry and everything about
it. Yes, and the automobile industry.
Yeah. And then these two guys at the Eiffel Tower.
Well, those are two guys at the Eiffel Tower who happened to be there and had this idea that you could, you didn't have to hail a taxi. You could do it on your iPhone. And they went up there and talked about how to do it. Do you need to own the cars or do you just need to have the software to do it? And everybody, you know, would be self-employed. And they're the two founders of Uber. And they got stuck in a snowstorm, and nowhere to go. They went up to the top of the Eiffel Tower and, you know, kind of hammered out the idea for Uber. So love the picture.
And then, you know, you've talked about renewable and solar and wind, and these are just from China.
Well, we've had a shale revolution I talked about. We've had a solar revolution. The cost of solar panels is like down 85%. And a lot of that is because of Chinese manufacturing scale and juggernaut and power. And this is in China where they're putting the panels on the roof. And China provides 70% of the world's solar panels, and Chinese companies elsewhere another 10%. So China is very well positioned in solar energy. And that fall in costs has taken something that was not competitive and made it very competitive now.
And in the last picture, you mentioned it's the last chapter of the book. This is kind of a scary picture. Those are all full tankers.
Yeah, those oil tankers that when the economic dark age descended and businesses weren't running and people were staying home and no one was on the road and commuting, you had this flood of oil that was coming in. And those were all tankers off the coast of Los Angeles that simply couldn't unload the oil because there was no place to put the oil. And it was that then led to this thing where the U.S. really brokered a deal to stabilize the oil market, which would have been kind of unthinkable And, you know, prices are still low, but now there are places to put the oil. But, you know, a lot of people still are not, most people are still not commuting.
Dan, I just want to thank you for a very informative conversation, for talking with some of our audience, for you know, just putting all of this together. And it's a great book, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it.
Well, thank you, Kerry. I'm very glad that I had the chance at the American Writers Museum to talk about writing, which I often don't get a chance to do, because it's an activity that you mainly do by yourself. You know, it's not a group activity. Secondly, to talk about, you know, the issues that we've done. And I think the questions really show the focus that people have on energy transition, how it's developing. And so, you know, those questions were very much, you know, went to really key questions. And to, you know, talk about these issues, which I find very interesting, but also, as I think you found, you read the book, it's, you know, it's a great story too. A lot of really interesting people in it, and, you know, a lot of surprises. So glad to have a chance to talk about the new map. Thank you, and thank the museum.
Oh, thank you, Dan. Thank everybody who joined us today. And everyone should get a good read of it. And I recommend the hardcover, as the Kindle does not put the pictures until the end of the book. If you do download it, scan to the back so you can see the pictures. They're a lot of fun. So thank you, Dan. And thank you very much,
Kerry.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, hear from Caldecott Medal winning author and illustrator Uri Shulovitz about his new memoir, Chance, Escape from the Holocaust, presented in partnership with the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.